Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this latest edition, this primetime edition of the Cyril Quinn Review on this 17th, amazingly, 17th of September 2014. This, as we discussed, Boardwalk Empire Season 5, Episode 2, The Good Listener, and a little news in the NFL, if you hadn't heard. You know, a couple things going on in the league where I can't, like, we're in a league where nothing is to be believed. I can't even say no contract is guaranteed, but, you know, we'll get on that as well. But as always, I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues, Rob Sapp, Chad Quinn. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
What's up?
Oh, boy, the pre-show. If only you guys got wind of the pre-show. It's like the back in the Temple days, the pre-party. Sometimes the pre-party can be better than the actual party. But we begin with Boardwalk Empire. We'll start out in 1884 with really the kind of the beginning of the end, as far as I'm concerned, in my opinion, of the Nookie versus father relationship. Nookie's sister, of course, dies after her battle with tuberculosis. And, you know, this was a chilling scene, but this was a very eerie scene because, you know, the dead bodies laying there. I know it was back in the day. Then you hear some flies. And at that point, I'm thinking to myself, well, damn, how long has she been there where flies are around? Well, it turns out that our buddy Ethan more than likely drunk away the funeral money. And of course, of course, the wife is not happy. And it's one of those situations where boyfriend, husband, wife, you know, the husband knows he's wrong, but he really doesn't have an answer. Like, honey, did you call the plumber? Plumber. It was one of those situations where clearly the undertaker was not paid. He's not showing up because he wasn't paid. And Nookie, of course, sees this. And then you have, a situation where Nookie gets into it with his father, basically about the Commodore. And the Commodore, and Nookie says, you know, the Commodore says he would, you know, she'd be buried proper. His father says, okay, you made your choice. The Commodore shows up, tries to give gives Ethan some money for the funeral. Ethan, of course, plays a tough role, you know, pulls out the shotgun, but of course he takes the money. and the thing you got out of that was more into the past history of Ethan and the Commodore, as the Commodore said, hey, look, the land you paid for was fair, or how much I paid for it was fair, and so on. But at that point, to me, that was the nail in the coffin as far as that Ethan-Nookie relationship, because obviously, you know, Ethan, I mean, Nookie's no fool. He understands that his father's alcoholic, and probably, and like the mother, like the wife, probably assumes that his father drunk, you know, done the funeral money. What were our thoughts on that particular sequence of events?
Rob, you got it. You can start.
I mean, I'm going to be fascinated by like what we talk about here today. Me and Chad didn't have a chance to talk, and me and Cyril talked a little bit this morning about it. Honestly, oh man. All right, so let me give a disclaimer.
Okay.
Boardwalk Empire, brilliant show. I wish we had done episode by episode of season 4. Because that was some of the best television I've ever seen, and some of the bravest television that's ever been on. So I need to say that. I need to say how much I love this show. With that being said, I really could have cared less about the entire flashback. Literally. I need, like, I need to see that to understand the relationship between Nucky and the Commodore and his father. Like, I didn't need to see all of that. It felt a little bit like over-explaining to me. You know, particularly with the sister, like, that was never, ever brought up before, unless I'm very wrong. I don't really remember him talking about it before, his brother.
I think it was brought up in passing that his sister had passed away, but pretty, like, it wasn't a major point of emphasis.
Okay, yeah. Right. And so, also, like, that was never, I guess my point was that, yeah, I'm sure it was somewhere brought up. They're smart writers. They're not going to just make something up on the fly. But it was never connected to Nucky's emotional state in the way that he operates and does things, you know? So,
exactly.
Again, it essentially comes down to my father was an alcoholic, and he treated me like crap. The Commodore was my surrogate father.
Right.
That can be said. That was said. It had been done, like, the early on with the relationship with the father. The flashback, I just didn't. It's over-explaining on a time. You have such a short timetable that I'm not exactly sure why it's included. Those are my thoughts.
Right. Okay. And so I was fine with the scene, but I couldn't agree more with Rob's remarks. As it relates to, was it necessary? No, we kind of understood it, and it wasn't so much revealing anything that we didn't know or think anyway. I would say, you know, the Commodore said one thing to Nucky about, okay, boy, take solace in your work. And I think that speaks to, for me at least, why Nucky can't just quit anyway, and we'll get into that. You know what I mean? I think he's so regimented that this is the only place to give some peace is the business, is the work. You know what I mean? So I think part of it was necessary. They didn't have to try to pull at your emotional, you know, appeal or whatever. But I was fine for it because I understand that, Rob, you speak from a very biased place because when you watch a show, you watch a show. You get in it, like you should. But, you know, to the casual viewer, I can see them like, oh, wow, that all makes sense. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
I had to take it outside of my own. Yeah, because I'm like you. I had to take it outside of my own lens and not trying to give us extra credit or whatever, which I did anyway. But it's like, to the casual viewer, I could see them doing it, but also a lot of times when we get to a series finale, whether it's intentional or not, regardless of how great the writers are, they always want to pay homage to the people they have to get rid of. You know, and we already knew from, you know, talking last week, this is Nucky season. You know what I mean? Of course we know Boardwalk Empire is about Nucky, but if you didn't know that, you definitely know now. You know what I mean? So I think they're going to continue to have these flashbacks. We might even see him when he's in college. It ain't no telling. You know what I mean? Because this is just a pattern I'm seeing with Nucky as we follow him.
When we get to, like, I have a flashback that I would really like to see, and I'm pretty sure it's coming, but we'll get to that, like, in the what we would do portion.
So that's the only thing I would say, too, like, to wrap it up, is that, you know, even with Nucky being his bootlegger, we never really see him indulge. Like, he does liquor, he drinks a lot, but not like that. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Can
I make one point? Like, my argument is not against flashbacks. I have nothing to do with it. But I think about the episode where they did Jimmy's life, right? Like, that was,
Don't even go there. The best flashback in cinematic history. And the most necessary one. The most necessary one to explain that craziness. So we can't compare that to. I get you. You're not saying you have a problem with flashbacks. You're just saying basically was it necessary when you got seven more episodes. So
yeah, it's yeah.
Again, I'll stick to what I've said previous episode we did. I hate the flashbacks. I can't. They're an absolute waste of time. But if you're going to do it, please further advance the storyline of the flashback. I mean, please, like you said, it was nothing. I could, like, all due respect to the sister character, I could care less about his sister dying. It doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't. It's just something there that happened, and it's like okay, this is. Did we need to see that in order for us to know that his dad was a terrible father? No. So, that's all I have to say about the flashbacks. I hate them. They're a waste of time. But again, they're going to continue to show them because, like you guys said, it is Nucky's season. So we
now, real quick, and this is a stretch, so y'all can throw this away. But if anything, the death of his sister doesn't necessarily speak to his relationship with his dad, but maybe Nucky's being able to be so immune to death, period. Because he's not ever been a real gangster, you know, but when he's been in the past in these situations where he had to kill people, or, you know, with the Jimmy even, he does it. And I've always wondered where that came from without him really being in the street, so and so. I'm just throwing that out there. But anyway.
Maybe. Moving on to New York City, 31. Nucky, of course, has come back from Cuba, and he meets up with now retired Johnny Torrio, ex-Don Johnny Torrio, who is chilling but not chilling. Torrio, of course, returns to his roots back in New York. That's where he originated from, with Al Capone, Frankie Yale, and guys like that. And Torrio basically is kind of like, Torrio's basically saying, like, dude, you know, wrap it up. Like, you want to end up like me with a bullet in your neck, that basically barely
right.
could, you know, chew food and, you know, have trouble drinking. Like, it's time. He's basically saying, hey, it's time to get out. He encourages Nucky to have the face-to-face with Marizano to find out what's going on. And Nucky, you know, Nucky says, and then, you know, they make a reference, of course, to talk about Joe Masseria and his, and of course, Nucky connects all the dots, as you know, as we thought he would, as far as Masseria and him trying to, and him being basically attempt on his life within, you know, a day or two. So that leads to them, of course, them meeting with Marizano and Luciano. Of course, you have no Lansky because, of course, Luciano and Lansky are attempting to keep Marizano on the outs as far as their partnership, having Marizano think that they're not, you know, working together, which, we know they are. And, you know, Marizano basically saying, listen, you have nothing, no reason to fear me. Nucky, classic Nucky, you know, who said I was scared. He questions Luciano. Of course, they deny, and you go and you have that particular scene, and of course also Tonino, Jip Rossetti's ex number two, former number two, was present at the meeting. What did we take from that? What did we like since? Rob mentioned earlier, but what did we like and what didn't we like about that particular scene?
I'll go first here. And this goes back, and you know, we said this last week, with all the stuff we didn't like about the first episode, we all, you know, me and Rob in particular said this, I have so much confidence in the writing of the show. So from here on out, the show really picked up for me personally. You know what I mean? And this is where I say, yeah, the flashback wasn't necessary, but they still moved on really quickly on some old, kind of like Game of Thrones does. Like, they didn't waste time with the whole whodunit routine. It started to get into it. I'm not going to go too far. But What I took from that scene, I really liked the exchange with Nucky and Toriel. You know, it really speaks to the title of this episode, just good listener. You know, and basically saying, look, man, whether Capone got set, it doesn't even matter. This is the game we're in, and this is it's inevitable what's going to happen if you stay in it. Like, you take this advice or not, but you need to get out of it, you know. And, you know, Nucky being who Nucky is, he's going to do what Nucky does. But I really just appreciated the scene, having those big personalities all together and just speaking honestly, you know, without all the shenanigans and everything.
Yeah, I mean, like, agreed, 100%. This is the stuff that's going to get – this is the stuff that gets my juices flowing on,
yeah,
on Boardwalk Empire. You know, these scenes – with this really well established personalities, having like these conversations. So like the writing was just impeccable. The acting was fantastic. I also really like, to your point, Chad, I think that you know, like, it, and you know, you gotta love the play on words, the play on, like, you know, good listener. If you were being a good listener, you would take Toriel's advice and be out of this game, because these young bucks are coming. That's inherent in like what he's saying in it. And of course, Nucky is not going to pay attention to that. So it's just like, that's the type of insight on the character that is just like, you know, that whole he's driving his own self, that he's the driver of this. He has total opportunities to get out, to be done with it, yet he just can't. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the scene.
So the question I would have about this, and this will kind of not connect to a later scene, but is his money situation. Does he not want to get out because of the life, or does he not want to get out because he might be broke? Because you remember, he said that in a meeting when he met up with Joe Kennedy, and I mean when Joe Kennedy and had in the boardroom about when he's trying, you know, sell himself, trying to, you know, say, hey, I'm the best bootlegger in the country, and so on, that the Great Depression hit him, the crash affected him a lot. I mean, is it a financial or just an ego situation with Nucky? And so him not wanting to get out.
I mean, that goes back to what I said at the top with the flashback where, you know, the Commodore says, take silence in your words. I think ultimately it's about ego and the business. You know, even for him to have to, in the boardroom, say who he was and what he did, it was like, are you serious? You know what I mean? Like, okay, if we're going to play that game. And I think that's why he can't let go. This is his vice. This is his fix, you know. And I think because it's kind of like, you know, if you use the analogy of like a, you know, basketball player, Michael Jordan in particular. Jordan still thinks he can beat anybody in the NBA. He just does. If he was physically healthy and able, because of his mind, he just thinks, I still can outthink them, you know. And although this life of crime that they are in is a thinking man's game, it's also a very young man's game. And I think that it's not so much about the money as it is just, I'm Nucky. No one's going to get over on me. I always see you coming type mentality.
I was going to say, to borrow a phrase from many different sources, but lately of a television show that just ended, My Name Is My Name.
It's just a simple.
See, I wasn't even gonna bring up the name. I was just gonna just let it. Those who know what I'm talking about. But it's like, it's that. It's My Name Is My Name. It's always like, you know, the next score. Always looking for the next one. Always looking for the next one.
Yeah.
I think it's probably implied in there somewhere that Nucky isn't as financially stable as he was, but I think that's just, you know, the money's like, what do they say about business, like super wealthy businessmen? Money's just a way to keep score. So it's right. just that's just a way to just keep score of how big he is. But it's about his name. It's about his reputation. It's about his the way that he thinks, his mind, his all of that.
Yeah, I believe Nucky could get out if he want. He could get out and be financially set. I can't see Nucky has so many talents that politically, business wise, even with the crash, I feel like he is a type that had money put away and good investments. I think it is about his name more than it is. Like he may not be rich in terms of Nucky rich, super in terms of Nucky rich, but as far as being able to retire and be comfortable and go into something else because he has that kind of talent, I think he could. I think he easily.
You're getting lost in it.
The first two episodes, Nucky's been disrespected. Okay?
Right.
Episode one, the guy's continuously late for his meetings. Number two, they're acting like, who are you? So, I mean, you're just seeing this guy in this world that he doesn't believe he even lives in. You know what I mean? Like, people are not recognizing who he is, or who he was, I should say, but he's still living that.
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah, so we move now to Chicago, and we get in, not introduced, but we finally see three of our favorite characters in Capone, Van Alden, and of course Eli. We'll go Capone first. Capone is at the top of the heat. We know 1931, he was fully in total control of the Chicago gangland. He's doing a variety interview with Variety magazine. They're talking, comparing him to like Little Caesar, Public Enemy, these famous movies that may have or may not have been based on parts of his life. He's just over the top, out of control, looking at, you know, his facial scar, trying to put makeup on his facial scar, which showed that he really was into he might really been heavy into still taking and sniffing cocaine, because he kind of seemed he was kind of not delusional, but again, he's in total control, has all these guys around him in the Lexington Hotel, of course, where he stayed at, where he was headquarters for, where he was at for like 4 years, and the scene begins where he's like paging Mike D'Angelo, paging Mike, and like, you know, who is Mike? So he has everybody just running around looking for this one guy, and it turns out that the guy was one of his top lieutenants who was basically in charge of Van Alden and Eli. So we can split this up because Van Alden and Eli is another issue. That probably was my favorite part of the episode. Those two, it was hilarious. How about Capone and where he's at now and just his demeanor, his mannerisms, you know, just his mindset.
I'm super short on this. I really like the actor who plays Capone. I really like him. He's really good, and I just really like him. As far as everything else, it's just like, you know, the Capone story. We know, everybody knows it. You know, it's all of that is known. So it's like how like the different pieces that the actor brings out of it. That I really like. I definitely didn't think it was like delusional between like the rubber and the scar, just to like to focus on a minor detail. But just like we like people know the story, Capone, he, you know, like every like the media and everybody around him was calling him Scarface. He hated that. If somebody called him Scarface, he would beat him to death. So without saying this is what like acting, you know, directing, where the brilliance of it is just like in that moment, him rubbing that scar just kind of like gives you all of that without having to say it at all.
Yeah.
You know, which is why I said I love him. you know, in the role. So, done.
No, you nailed it. I think if any character from this period piece was depicted, as far as the time moving forward, so accurately, it was Capone in this scene specifically. Like, you know, to Rob's point, I don't think it has anything to do with the cocaine or whatever. It's more about his vanity. I mean, this narcissistic, schizophrenic killer is just, like, all over the place, man, all over the place. And like you said, that homage to the historians that know about how he hated to be called Scarface and this and that. It's the little nuances that were captured in this scene. And, you know, was it over the top? Yeah, because he was over the top.
He was over the top, like, yeah, no, absolutely.
It's like Leo in Wolf of Wall Street. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they went there, they went hard, and they only got like 3 minutes to kill it. So everything else is secondary. Let him do him. And I loved it, yeah.
How about Van Alden and Eli? Now, Eli, one of Capone's breweries, of course, gets raided. Eli, you know, wakes up to see it. He looks just god-awful, unshaven. You hear Van Alden basically, you know, criticize him, saying he smells of urine. Van Alden and Eli, of course, end up owing Capone $20,000. They get, you know, earful from Capone's, you know, Capone's top lieutenants, Mike D'Angelo, who turns out to be an undercover federal agent. So they're scrambling in terms of how to pay back this money. They end up killing two of Capone's men, and Van Alden says, you know, if I'm correct, and you certainly correct me if I'm wrong, is why always the pandemonium? I think
right,
that was the line
right,
he said.
Right,
yeah, I think
right,
that was the line he said
right,
to Eli.
Right.
Always the pandemonium. They're running. And, of course, again, yeah, those, like, just those two, the elevator scene with the fur, the lady, the dog, the fur hat, those two who can't stand each other. Let's be honest. They are absolutely the odd couple. But interestingly enough with those two, one, of course, is missing his family in Eli, and the other one in Van Alden is hating his family.
Oh, think about this scene. Like, oh, my gosh.
That, yeah,
oh, my goodness.
The Van Alden wife scene is like, you know, she's been speaking the same for all the seasons that she's been on, and all of a sudden he has a problem with her lack of English or proper English. So he's uptight. He looks like he got a new house, so life's not all bad. Looks like he got some new digs. But he's just hating life. The six-year-old is bothering him. And, you know, Eli's just absolutely in the dumps, just depressed. So those two, that's going to be those two together. I'm looking forward to where their storyline goes. Because they're gonna do something just out. They're gonna get in each other's way. You know, it's something gonna happen with those two just messing something up. What are our thoughts on those scenes? On those couple of scenes with Van Alden and Eli?
Yeah, I'll go first here.
Yep.
I have so much to say about this. I mean,
okay. I'm with you.
They honestly can have a spin-off show, and I'll watch every episode. I mean, sometimes you're able to watch something. And it has to just win. Great writing beats great acting. Whereas you can actually be watching a show and it'd be a terrible episode. And this is a great episode. But it could have been a terrible episode. But then this one scene just makes it. And I say that to say their back and forth would have made me satisfied regardless of what happened in the rest of the episode. That's how much I just loved the banter back and forth. But the other thing I'll say, to really speak to the point I'm about to get to, is as we talked last episode, the dangers of doing these pieces where you transition, speed up years, sometimes it doesn't flow. Last week we spoke a lot about cons to that. This right here highlighted the pros, because when you can show these transitions, I don't think anyone on the show, maybe I would argue Jillian, has had such an obscure obscure placement with Boardwalk Empire as Van Alden. I mean, this dude has been all over the map emotionally. He's been everywhere, you know. So I'll go real quick with Eli as far as, I mean, look, Eli is now a two-bit crook. You know what I mean? Smelling like a piss, missing his family. You know, it's pretty sad that, in a sense, him and his brother are parallel for different reasons. You know what I mean? They both look like they're at the demise, but Lucky's the only one that doesn't realize it. And, you know, Eli just seems like he's just waiting for whatever to end him. You know what I mean? Now, Saru, I think you missed the point when you said Van Alden didn't have a problem with his wife before. No, he did. The transition is he is now in power. Like you said, he has a bigger house. He would never, prior to the season, have the goal to take that cigarette out of her mouth. You know what I mean? Like, he runs the show, and she shut up and sat there because he finally is the man. Like, she demasculated this dude every scene, every episode. He came home, got blood on his face, just wanted a piece, and she's like, what are you doing? Go get the money. Like, so for now Van Alden, and I love the way they did it because, of course, he despises his family. And I didn't mean to say the word yet because that line itself, when he says, I just think sometimes it's that much easier to just despise them. And I mean, I love everything.
That was a great line.
I just love everything about their exchange and Van Alden in particular. Like now, because you think about how he was freaking out when he had to kill someone at the time. Now it's just like, come on, let's just do this. You know, he's changed so much. So I really appreciate that. And I'm done.
I mean, this is why we love the show for this entire interaction. You focus a lot on Van Alden, so I'll focus a little bit more on Eli.
Okay,
and I agree 100% with everything he said about Van Alden. As a matter of fact, I love it's a 360 with a twist, maybe like a 365, where it's like he's completely secure and comfortable in the position that he's in, just like when we first kind of met him, like being the Uber FBI agent or the federal, whatever agent. He's completely secure and comfortable in this life of crime, you know. So it's like that 360 with a twist that I just find just so interesting. But Eli is the antithesis of Jesse in a sense of, like, his suffering has been so multi-layered through every single season that it's become a beautiful art in a way. Like, I was so impressed with his acting, and I was so impressed with where the character was at that point in time. You're absolutely right when you say, like, this is the beauty of Jumping Time Ahead, because it would have been unnecessary to show, you know, like the six or whatever years, how many and how beaten down and everything. I think that's where the other show kind of got lost in that, like showing every single painful moment. No, we come in and he is just done. And you're absolutely right. He is him and Nucky have always been two sides of the same coin, right? And it's like same instance, they're two sides of the same coin. They're both kind of hurtling towards their own destruction. Just one is completely oblivious of it, and the other is welcoming it, almost embracing it. I don't know, dude. Is this the appropriate time to talk about, like, the money? Like, them, after they kill him, they bring back the money?
No, go ahead.
Can I talk? Okay, beautiful. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This is what tied, like, just, this is just what ties this episode in a knot for me. But I almost think it's like a a microcosm of the entire series. It's like, you know, we see all these bumps and struggles that Van Alden and Eli are going through to run around and get this money, right? And even in this, you know, this scene is complete debacle. They're killing, they're opening, everything like that. And it's like, huh, we find, you know, we got this $20,000 to satisfy Capone. They walk in and literally they just turn it on and it's just like a drop in the bucket.
Nothing, basically, yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, money just is no acknowledgement at all. You know, it was just like that is what this that is in essence what this show has been about. It's like there's this machine, this mechanism that is not to get too deep, but capitalism, but how it's been formed in Atlantic City and New York and all this time of this machine of just like gathering more money, no matter, you know, what pain and chaos that surrounds it. And actually, you know, the money machine will always keep moving. I am getting beat. The money machine will always keep moving, no matter who dies, no matter who is in the insane asylum, no matter who, you know, who kills whose nephew and everything like that. So actually the pursuit of this money and trying to put it in there is actually completely in vain because there's like more and more and more that'll be piled on. So anyway, I can't say enough about how that Eli Van Holden arc and just like that scene and then how all that is just beautiful. Perfect.
Yeah.
So get back to Nucky. Couple things with Nucky. Very interesting conversation he had with his bodyguard. Nucky's, you know, basically not philosophizing, but a little philosophizing. Basically saying, look, I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. You know, if I walk away, you know, basically they'll think I'm weak. If I fight them, then it's a war. And I loved, this probably might be my favorite line of the whole first two episodes. This is what the bodyguard says. I kill them, I know kill them. Those are the exact words, whatever you say. Yeah. He says, I kill them, I know kill them, whatever you say. Basically, his bodyguard is basically like, look, man, forget all this philosophizing, all this pity party. What are we doing? It's like, what do you want to do? And I thought that was, like, again, I don't know who that, I've seen the actor before, he plays the bodyguard. He's been around for a while. But I love his dialogue with Nucky in that particular scene. Then we go to, and I'm going to go into a mini rant after this disguise particular scene.
Mini rant.
Tonino, yes, rant. So, real old rant alert. Tonino
back.
Yes, yeah. Well, he was back. All right, rest in peace, Tonino. Yeah. Tonino, for whatever reason, meets with Nucky. And keep in mind, Tonino, of course, is working, of course, with Lansky Siegel. And Luciano, but they really don't have respect for him. But you know, he's been a good soldier. Siegel likes him, says, hey, you know what, keep him around. He meets with Lucky in a restaurant. Nucky in a restaurant, and Nucky basically says, listen, you can talk or you can die. So it basically is your choice. He sings like a canary, and then has the gall, even after Nucky has given him about 1,000 hints that, you know what, I'm probably going to kill you, by saying that, look, how can you work with people who you don't trust? And then Nucky, and then he says, you know, Mr. Thompson, I will work for you in a heartbeat, you know, sign me up. But after he sung like a canary, saying that, you know, giving away the plan that Lansky and Luciano have for Marizano and what have you, He still asked to sign up to try to work with Nookie. Nookie said, "Yeah, sure. You know, come by, swing by my place tomorrow morning. We'll, you know, work out the details." And then, of course, we know that his fate was sealed when Nookie tells the waiter, you know, she was a great singer, good actress, whatever. And that's the picture of Billy Kent. Of course, Tonino was played a part in killing Billy Kent and blowing up the Onyx Club before it was the Onyx Club. I think it was called Babette's or something to that nature. And of course he gets in classic Mickey fashion, knife in the back, postcard, greetings from Havana, and he gets, you know, right in front of the brothel that Lansky, Luciano, and Siegel are you know, own and are stationed at. Mini rant alert. This is one of the Tonino has to be one of the dumbest criminals in television history. I'm like, dude, how did you even get in the mafia? Really? Who? Were you Masuria's cousin? Were you, I don't know. I'm like, how could you even think for a second that Nookie, first of all, I wouldn't even took the meeting with Nookie myself. I'm like, dude, I would have went with the bodyguard. You got to kill me on the spot. Or matter of fact, no, I'll shoot you. Yeah. But he probably was dumb enough where he didn't even have a gun, probably. That's how dumb he is. I'm like, and again, the writing was perfect because he is an idiot. So I have no problem with the writing. But I was like, you big dummy, to actually believe that Nookie would hire you, who's gotten around more than, you've been in everybody's bed as far as the criminals goes. You know you're not to be trusted. So that's my mini Tonino rant. But again, Nookie, of course, Nookie.
Well,
two things to get out of that is, number one, Nookie, of course, is still bothered and still feels somewhat guilty about the Billy Kent, about his role in Billy Kent's death. So I got that. I took that out of that, and also, of course, that he's not going out laying down, sending a message to, you know, Lansky and company.
Yeah, I'll go real quick. As far as, you know, Nookie still not being over her desk, I think we've already seen in Nookie's personality, even with the way he interacts with Eli, that he forgives but doesn't forget, in a sense. You know, once you cross Nookie, your relationship with him is forever changed. That's just who Nookie is. But I'll be very brief as far as your mini rant. I think you're completely right, but it's misplaced. It's not so much about, you know, intelligence. It's his character. He's a rat, okay? So a rat reeks of desperation. There's no common sense there. They're loyal to whoever's there in the moment. So when you said you went into the meeting, you would have thought, of course, you got common sense. You got common sense. You know what I mean? Tonino don't even think that Lucky would smile his way. It's ridiculous. You know, so he was just the classic definition of a rat, of a pawn that they use and highlighted. You know, because you can always say, like, how did these type of people get into life of crime and, you know, get together with these people of higher rank? Because a rat is always needed, because you can always use him as a pawn as you please, and which Nookie clearly did. So that's all I have to say about your rant. But, no, great, like you said, great scene, great writing. It wasn't at all anything negative to say about the show. But once again, I go back to just my whole Game of Thrones kick I've been on with this show, this episode, just not wasting time. You know, just, okay, this scene and the next scene you're gone, or next scene I'm going to expose what happened in the last scene. Like, I just love the way they did that.
Yeah, no, I agree. We can move on.
Yeah, so I think we all agree that this second episode was better than the first. But I think that we still got a lot shoved in our faces, because we've talked, you know, for the last 45 minutes or so, and we had, and we still didn't mention, and I'll run off these characters that were either debuted or introduced: Elliot Ness, Joe Kennedy. They bring back, of course, Willie Thompson and Jillian. So we got all that shoved in our faces, along with the storylines we just described. And Joe Kennedy, I'm going to get into the Joe Kennedy character. I think he'll be fascinating. Jillian, I don't know what they're doing with Jillian. I don't know. Jillian, we know has been a classic plot mover over the course of the seasons. I don't know. Again,
Really quickly.
Go ahead.
Jillian's a character, right? She's a character, and I think we can dive in depth in her. Kennedy can't be a character. He just can't. That has to be a walk by and just kind of like a wink and a nod to, like, you know, like we all know, like the. Here's the wink and the nod. He can't be a character. It's too much. Here's the wink and the nod, right? It's like Nucky is trying to be, he's trying to move into legitimacy, and he's trying to do that in a way that is viewed as okay. He's not going to succeed. Kennedy was the one who was able to succeed in that. There's so much underneath that I don't even want to go into the next, you know, 15-20 minutes of explaining all the complexities of that. Jillian needs to be the one that is like, what's going on here?
See, it's real. I'm going to have to text you later, because I'm not going to call you on the show. I'm not going to call you out on the show, because I can't say what I want to say. But you are completely right when you say she's a plot mover, right? She represents for this show what you want Chalky to represent. And clearly there's no Chalky in this episode. I mean, we saw him last week. But by that, I mean, like, you have naturally high aspirations for Chalky and thinking that he'll be something to the alternate plot of the show this season. And maybe you could be right. I just don't see it.
I mean, what are they doing with Jillian? She's writing letters. Like, who is she writing letters to? I'm very interested to see how that moves along, how that filters in the rest of the show, how that impacts the show.
Right. So let me further explain the comparison with Jillian and Chalky real quick. So, for instance, if hypothetically speaking, neither one of them really moves the show forward or backward, right? The care that they put in just in this one episode with Jillian's character is so consistent. It's so consistent. Whereas Chalky's, so I don't know what they're going to do moving forward. I'm only talking about what I've seen. It was so redundant. It was a huge difference in where the characters are for me. Like you said, right, you know, we talked about a lot. Okay, now he got a new black friend that's annoying him. And, you know, he's just sitting there. We saw that already with Chalky. And it wasn't really the best of Chalky we've seen. So we can argue that we've seen Jillian being crazy. But the thing is, her character is so I guess I have so much pain and empathy for her. You know what I mean? I love how they and you're thinking that, you know, she's like, you're trying to figure out how in the hell is she in the, you know, chilling, relaxing in the spa or whatever. And then, you know, second later.
I did like how they did that. That was well written. I had no problem with the scene. I had no problem with the scene. I'm just wondering the writing of the scene. I'm just wondering where are they going with her character, considering there are only 6 episodes left, and considering how layered her character is, important her character has been for over the past 4 seasons.
I guess ultimately what I'm saying is, and maybe it's just a difference of opinion, I wouldn't necessarily bet on either of them, but I have more faith that Jillian's character will have more to do with the ultimate plot than I do Chalky. That's where I'm coming.
Okay.
Yeah. But I love everything about Jillian and her scene. You know, anytime she's on there, she kills it, and it's always something ridiculously crazy.
That was crazy. So, predictions for, based on what we see out of the last two, first two episodes, predictions moving forward, where are we at right now? We gotta know that, we gotta think that Narcisse is coming, probably next episode.
What was the episode? What was the name of the first episode last week?
Anybody? Man, how did I forget
Hold
this?
Hold on, I can do it right now.
Golden days for girls and boys. Okay.
Yeah, golden days for boys and girls.
For boys and girls, okay.
Okay, golden days for boys and girls. Good listener.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just starting in terms of predictions moving forward based on the first two episodes that we've seen.
Simply put, I think that from a pacing standpoint, once you pick up, you can't slow back down, and you do have six more. So I think we start to see some blood. I mean, we saw a little.
Okay.
I think we get bloodier, you know, moving on to episode three, and more things are just revealed. So I think, you know, because I took the good listener as a double entendre for, you know, nothing. I mean, you talk about the beginning, how the episode started with the ear and everything, and ended with the ear.
Right. Yes.
You think about Toriel's conversation with Nucky, but I think also a good listener is us, the audience, the consumer. You know, for these hints they're dropping. I mean, I know we, you know, for sake of time, we really didn't want to get into William, but I love his scene. You know,
yeah,
I love his interaction because, you know, it got me because I'm like, what side is he playing for the fool? Because he was so convincing, trying to get a position as a lawyer. And then he has to sit down, you know, when he calls him, you know, my dad's brother or whatever. And then he sits down with Nucky. And, you know, so it's like,
Where's his relationship with
right,
Nucky?
Is he ultimately trying to get revenge for Nucky, you know, tearing his family apart? In a sense, this guy who he once wanted to emulate, his cool uncle, he really sees what this life of crime does and how it destroys families. Is that sincere? I don't know, but I am intrigued by his character. And, you know, I think they do a good job of now – two episodes in, they're throwing more and more angles at you, whereas you go down one block and they say, okay, yeah, they want to kill him, so, you know what I'm saying? and I love how they're going to continue, I believe, you saw as far as where it goes, I think they continue to reveal, it's almost like the Mr. Burns when he got shot episode. it's going to be more revelations of who else might have an issue with Nucky as we continue down. Maybe
so
bring Chalky back in. I don't, you know, that'd be, if I wrote
it. Chalky will still have a say. I'm going to stick to that Chalky will still have a say.
Maybe I just sold myself on it a little bit, but I'm just saying, like, I think that we continue to go down that road of people tying with Nucky and where they stand with him.
The Willie
whether
thing
that's good or bad. But yeah, that's it.
The Willie thing was very interesting because we assumed after last season that Willie was supposed to be Nucky's apprentice, per se, and how he revered him. And I definitely like what they did with what they're doing with Willie based on, you know, this first episode that he appeared in. And I don't have any like exact predictions, but I just get a sense that this and how the season is going to progress is I believe that all the walls around Nucky are going to cave in. Like, I think that that's where I see it going. Like, he keeps getting turned down as far as the business aspect. He's not listening to Torrio. Of course, you got the young boys, with, of course, Luciano and Lansky and Siegel. And now this Willie angle. And even, no, and remember, even Chalky. Chalky's not, they're not on the ground.
That's what I was
terms,
saying. That's
like,
what I was saying.
So
I know.
I see the walls caving in, and how does Nook navigate all of that, fighting everybody? Because Nookie's been a guy who's had multiple alliances, you know. Will he have any friends left? And who is his friends? And even we mentioned last week, Sally Wheat, you know, how we think that she's, you know, not on board with him as well, along with the senator. The senator to a lesser extent, but in particular Sally, because she obviously has a stronger relationship.
What was that line? What was the line in the show?
What are you talking about?
It was the same editorial. They were all together when they were talking about Tonino, when Nucky saw him. Someone said something. Damn it, I can't think right now. And the only reason I bring it up is because, going back to, you know, your mini rant about Tonino, I think, Rob, the other microcosm is people follow who's in power, you know, and so much of Nucky's relationships were not because the people liked him.
No.
It was because of what he can do. And as we continue to go down this road, and I told you the first two episodes, we've seen him disrespected twice now, they're showing the power being stripped from him. You know, so it's not even necessarily that everyone has to have this vendetta against him. It's just, you can do nothing for me. And I mean, and Nucky was very blunt when he told that to Chalky before. You know, basically, we're not friends.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So you're calling on me to help you, but we're not friends. Everything that we've done is for business.
Oh, I don't think this is a particular scene, particular line that you're talking about, but I did find okay, so Nucky says, so Marizano says, and new ones are Lucky says, people drift friendships, and Marizano says, and new ones are forged. Then Nucky knows his Tonino and says, allegiances as well. I don't know, is that what you're talking about, what he said to Tonino?
Yeah, that was the vicinity. It was right there. Maybe I just interpreted something, but yeah, it was definitely right there. It was right there. Two lines up or two lines down.
two lines up. But
either way, yes. Within all of that.
Can I call my shot on a prediction?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Since that's what we were originally talking about.
No, go ahead.
So, Nucky's going to be killed by someone close to him. My initial thought is Eli, but I can see Chalky doing it. I think.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more. I'm back. Now,
I think Luciano and Lansky and all of them, they make somebody an offer, which is why I'm thinking like Eli. Maybe get your, you know, we can help you get your life back if you do X. So I'll call the shot. Eli kills Nucky.
You going Eli?
That's the shot. I'm going with Eli.
Wow. I'm going Eli tries to kill Nucky, but Willie jumps in and he kills him.
Well, he shoots Willie.
Willie kills him first. No, I don't know, but like I won't go that far. I can't predict Nucky dying. I want to need one more episode so I can completely firmly say that and stick to it. But I definitely am buying Chalky back in it now. Because now I'm thinking from a writing standpoint and where it could go. Because last week I couldn't see it other than just somebody wanting it to happen. But now things are being revealed. I could see it. And they need to quit. The only thing I'm going to call for next episode, Narcisse better be in episode 3.
I think you're definitely going to see Narcisse. Episode 3 will be called, it's called What Jesus Says. That's the title of that's the title of the next episode, What Jesus Says,
okay.
Which is very interesting. Man, I think
that's Narcisse all day. Yeah, anyway.
I don't know who, but I think Nucky does die, though. I see. I'm really.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
even
yeah, we all know he's going to die.
I think Nucky dies. So, yeah, I think they're using the Luciano Lansky to kind of like throw smoke in our faces. It would be obviously they're going to have a tie into it, but I think that, like you said, I could definitely see them cutting a deal or basically saying, hey, you kill them or we'll kill you. But I definitely could see that. I mean, because they are going to be the powers. You know, they are going to be obviously the power brokers in terms of the show. So, I just
one real quick thing though before you end up going back to Jillian.
She hates Nucky too. Yeah, she definitely could be.
Yeah,
not only does she hate
Nucky, but what in the world does she want? You know, she told the guard, can I have what I want now? She said, once you give me what I want. She gave the guard what she wants, clearly, towards the end of the episode. So I'm intrigued
guard,
by what she wants.
The guard gave her, then the guard gave her some pen and paper. That's what I'm saying about the letters she wanted to write.
Oh, yeah, she's going
to
write. But who
is she writing to? Remember,
right.
And I'll say, I don't know where their relationship is at right now. Lucky and Jillian had, of course, a flame. So that could be another tie-in to what, you know, she can get her revenge.
I'm telling you, this is Mr. Burns. This is Mr. Burns' episode.
this episode, we're going to look back at this episode and be like, this is like the key episode.
What we have to do is figure out who is Maggie. Once you figure out who Maggie is, then you know who killed Maggie. Then you have to go through the Maggie's characteristics. Unassuming. No vendetta, no reason. Because we think we're being deep, but all we're doing is pulling from what we know. So everything we're saying makes sense. Everybody we're talking about has a motive. I'm going Maggie.
Yep.
I'm going Maggie. I'm going to figure out someone who has no motive. His old girl, the bland one. Maybe she, Margaret, who cares about her? Maybe she killed her. She's my Maggie right now. That's what I'm
going to Margaret, I doubt it. I mean, Margaret. Yeah, that's
I'd be so disappointed. I'd be so disappointed.
No, they're not gonna. They will not do that.
No, they wouldn't do that. Well, I don't know.
It's gonna be somebody who's capable of killing. Margaret's not capable.
See, once again, you're going off of motive and what you know, everything that makes sense.
Has Chalky ever had a scene with Jillian?
No. Well,
no,
they should have a scene.
Maybe she writes to Chalk.
Here we go. Hey, this is what happened. We're hanging on.
I know. This is where it breaks down.
I
would love to see them. I don't know how it happened, but man, it's the final season. They just like.
Yeah, put them together.
Chalky Jillian scene somewhere.
Bring Jimmy back for a flashback. Jimmy flashback scene.
Oh, what about Tommy? What about Tommy? Tommy got to be like 18 now. What is he, like 10? This 7 years later. Only got to be 17, 18. How about Tommy? Tommy killed Nucky. What about little Tommy? Tommy got to be a teenager now.
Oh, the baby. Oh.
Yes, no, he's not a baby.
Oh, that would
like,
be a little wire-ish.
He
was
like,
that's
kind of Maggie, though. That is kind of Maggie.
That's definitely Maggie. No, that's definitely Maggie. That's definitely Maggie. Like, what I'm saying, though, Tommy was
I
like,
mean, Nucky,
he had
Nucky
to be like
killed,
17,
Nucky killed his father.
Jillian might be on it because I've heard this rumor. Wow.
Yeah.
I've heard this rumor that Tommy does show up, that he does show up, and he's wearing a mask like his dad. Well, not his dad, but his dad. Wow. And that's only a rumor. But, yeah, I like that. We got a lot to play with in six episodes.
This episode just got better based on this last 10 minutes of our conversation. Chad, you got to run, right? It's 9:04.
Yeah, I do have to run. If you say anything real quick about football or whatever, let me know.
Go ahead.
I want to.
Yeah, you got.
It's
you
horrible.
You know what? The NFL is getting what they deserve. I compare it, and I thought the ride this morning is like the Titanic. It's this unbelievable ship world, state of the art, ahead of his time, and they were so worried about, so concerned about how great the ship looked, they didn't see the damn iceberg. And that's, and that, you know, Goodell with his power and the money, $10 billion, we're going to get it up to $27 billion by 2017. And forget about women getting slapped. Nobody cares. Forget about the concussions. Nobody cares. Forget about that. Nobody cares. We
want to continue to play you more and more games.
Yes. Yes. We want 18 games. Right. Yeah. We want 18 games. Come on. Forget about, you know, we'll cut complete
18 games. We're about to build a team in London. Like, whatever.
Yep, yep.
Just keep working.
Whatever.
Just keep working.
Whatever. We keep working. Keep working.
So real quick before I leave, the only thing to your point, Cyril, when the latest news on Ray Rice came out, my initial gut reaction was like, the audacity of this dude right now, that, you know, the time could not be worse as far as from court of public opinion standpoint, for him to do such a move. But then at the same time, I was like, the timing couldn't be better, because basically they made him the scapegoat.
They made
him the scapegoat. So I'm actually, and viewers, please don't take this the wrong way, because I have no love for the man or sympathy or respect for him. But I applaud what, huh?
I applaud.
But this is my Stephen A. moment. I may never do that. I'm gonna be so scared to talk next week. No, I shouldn't even preface all that, because I'm not saying anything pro domestic anything. I'm saying I applaud him basically threatening to bring everybody down, because ultimately with him doing what he's doing as far as trying to get reinstated, the question becomes, did you or did you not share what you said you shared?
Right.
That's what the ultimate question becomes, because Goodell said his story didn't add up with the video.
Yeah. Say it was ambiguous. That was Goodell's exact words.
You know what I mean? That's ultimately what he said. Like, no, now that we've seen the video, that changes everything. And if that's true, then of course the landscape changes. You know what I mean? But I can't stand the man, don't know the man, hate everything about what he did, but I'm intrigued to get down to the truth of the matter, and I feel like him doing this only expedites it. Because I know Goodell was like, oh, please, I will pay you out of my pocket, just shut up and sit down somewhere. I know he wanted to, I know he texted him, someone like, hey, you know, please, we got you. No. Go ahead, Ray, thick ass neck Rice, and your disrespectful self. You do that, brother. You do that. You play the victim and let America kill you, because they are going to kill you. But while you're dying, for me, bring it down with you. That's all I want. That's all I want. Y'all die together. That's it.
Well,
so hope I got the women fans back.
Go ahead, Seth.
All right, I do think there's some overall implications, some like bigger, larger implications. I agree with Cyril's analogy, although I think like I'm not sure what the iceberg is yet, but I think so. For the Ray Rice thing, I think the most interesting thing about that is that they actually got Goodell not to be the arbitrator. Right, they actually pushed him, to use a football term, pushed him off his spot. His spot has always been, you know, yep, I deal out the punishment and I also hear the appeals. You know, like that has been. So they got him completely moved off the spot, to the fact where there was even a press release where Goodell was like, oh, I never intended to hear be the arbitrator on this and hear the appeal. You know, so it's like, so that's a big deal. I think like the of course like the sponsorship and the money and all of that is like the biggest deal. But what I think I'm seeing, and what looks so interesting and fascinating, is the road that the union is making as this is happening, right? Like the big thing about this is all about labor peace,
Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not anything like that that can figure this out. Seems to me like if the and this is I'm very wary of this special commissioner exempt whatever
that Peterson
and Hardy are now in, where it's like the commissioner says and the commissioner does, and it's all about the commissioner and like everything like that. It almost feels to me like the union, the players' union, is building a case, and this could be the iceberg, of Goodell's incompetence to gain more power. And what I'm wondering is if this isn't a drumbeat to get – but anyway, so – yeah, so that's just kind of like, I think, like the overall implication. This feels like a, like the players' union spells blood and they're going to go in. Now, I don't necessarily know where going in is and where it all ends up, but I do think this is a time to push back. So to Chad's point with the appeal, from a public relations standpoint, no, this isn't a great time at all to do that. But in terms of the league being at its weakest, this is the perfect time to hit, to push back on every single thing you've ever wanted in every single way you possibly can in order to, you know, to get more of what you want.
Here's what I'll say about that. I absolutely agree with you from the standpoint that the opportunity is right there. The problem is they've been dealt, the players' union has been dealt a winning hand in terms of how to attack and come back to go at Roger Goodell without question. Problem is they don't know how to use it, and they don't know how to use it, and they, like, if this were the baseball people, their players' union, Goodell would be out there. And let's say baseball, they'd be out there. Because their baseball union, players' union, has always been amongst, like, the strongest in the world, maybe the strongest in sports, one of the strongest in the world, as far as when, in the golden, their golden days with Donald Fair and Orson, when they were running it, especially. These cats right here, they're on their own, like DeMar Smith, they're on their own agenda. They're not organized as a player. Now they're not as bad as the NBA is, who don't have any leadership. They don't even have a DeMar Smith per se. But they're not organized. They've been dealt a winning hand, and they will not know how to use it. I would predict that they will not have a clue in terms of how to use it to get Goodell out of there. Because like you said, the opportunity is there. They won't have a better chance to get Roger Goodell out of there than right now. But they'll mess it up. They'll mess it up.
Yeah.
I used a McNulty line from The Wire in season 5 when they were about to get the overtime, whatever, or when they thought they were going to get these promotions. McNulty said, "Yep, the white shirts are effing up." They'll find a way to mess it up.
And before I leave, and I know I'm leaving, but I think the difference with this player union, this is just me, my opinion, no facts behind this, but when you think about baseball, basketball, and NFL, if there's one team that defines culture, it would be the NFL. Like, they are a brotherhood. Like, when I look at the NBA, I still see more separation.
NBA is the worst.
So with that said, it's not to me with the NFL even just about competency. I think when you talk about the iceberg, it's the danger and fear of exposing all of us that even these players have that makes this such a touchy and tricky way to maneuver. Because, I mean, think about this. Prior to this Ray Rice fiasco, Peterson, all of this violence, right?
Right.
You talk about concussions, drugs, suspension. Players are off at the mouth left and right about Goodell.
Right.
So it would lead one to believe with the magnitude of what's going on, every player in the league will be talking about this dude right now.
Right.
But they're not. You still have your
feud. Absolutely. Yeah. To your point, I had somebody on the show Saturday talking about this, about the domestic violence. And it's nothing new in the NFL in terms of domestic violence, even before Goodell was commissioner. So,
well, everyone knows that. I mean, listen. When Michael Irvin,
Exactly. So you're absolutely right.
It's one thing for you to tell me. Listen, I'll play a fool if you want me to play a fool. Just pay me. I'll play the fool and say that half of y'all never hit the women. Okay, I'm not gonna play the fool that you're trying to do on Sunday and say I've never even seen this the way these players are acting. What the hell are y'all talking about?
No, right. Yeah.
Don't do that.
No.
We know that this has been around way longer than Goodell, and it's always been the culture, unfortunately. But my main point is this. I think that, yes, the players want Goodell out, but they have to be very calculated with pushing him out. And I think that ultimately, Rob, when you talk about the arbitrators who's overseeing this case, Surreal said this too, they're buying time. I think they're trying to give him a nice package ultimately. He is
I'll say
I basically I think like on a smaller scale, it's kinda like with the Danny Ferry situation. They're like, why didn't Danny Ferry just get fired? There's no need to get new owners. He's on indefinite leave. When the new owner comes in, they're clearing out the whole house. Danny Ferry will not be with the Atlanta Hawks again. He just won't.
No.
But there's just a way of going about things. They're doing things differently. It's more calculated. So Goodell will ultimately, they're trying to, if you will, make this mess as least messy as possible.
No, but
players buying in that, listen, we all have to cooperate for the brand, for the NFL. He'll go.
Here's what I say. I think they want him out, but they don't want him out. Because they have a lack of leadership amongst the players union. But let's think about all the stuff that they've gotten away with because of the power of their product, besides domestic violence. Now they're working out a drug deal now in terms of drug testing, but the bottom line is there's still no testing for HGH. Okay, it's on the table, but it's been on the table for however long. It's kind of like back taxes. All right, we're gonna let's put that file to the bottom of the pile, and then it'll come up in another 3 or 4 years, per se.
Right.
So I think they're smart enough per se to know if they fully expose Goodell, that the league might not be the kind of league that they want to play in.
Well, that's the only thing me and you disagree on. I agree with everything else you're saying. I don't think that's the fear, because I think it's the same thing you could look at with David Stern, where he left the NBA. Like, they get to a point where you have this machine going. Like, all of these regulations and the drug testing, they're not leaving when Goodell leaves. They're still not going to do that stuff. Ultimately, he's going to have to take the fall, and the players know that he has to go, and they do want him to go. Seriously, I don't think that their fear is that somebody's going to come in here, the culture of the NFL. The NFL culture will never change. And this is where...
Unless some sponsors. Now, it will change. If you get sponsors dropping, I think the culture will change. So,
Let me backtrack a little bit. It will change. I'm sorry. It will change, but the policies will change. The reactions will change. And I'm talking about, the thing is, even when you think about what Goodell said about the suspensions, when, you know, he first realized he dropped the ball on the Ray Rice thing, and then he went to 6-game suspension, what happens in society, we don't correct behavior, we correct actions.
Right.
That's what we focus on.
Right. We don't rebuild.
This is what they're going to do. They're going to correct the actions or lack thereof.
Right.
So disciplining will be better. the culture is the culture, and it will change and it will shift so much because of the action, the deeper ramifications. But ultimately, the behavior has to change. And I think even when I didn't even want to go here and be here, but it's like at the core of all of this, this is a microcosm of corporate America. Everyone knows it's always been the big boys club, you know, and I look at so many people who have so many vile things to say about Ray Rice for his vile acts, which I agree with them completely. But then I also sat there and said, you know what? Some people I'm seeing talk on social media, they do the same thing to their women mentally, cheating. And I think ultimately, in the core, what I'm trying to say is it comes down to disrespect. There's no respect for women. There's no respect for authority. Even in the case of Adrian Peterson, yes, I was beat with branches when I was a kid. Listen, you know, it's time to change. You are a 275-pound man.
And
I
it's
mean,
a 4-year-old.
There's no,
and it's a 4-year-old.
And it's a 4-year-old. But I think what comes down to it, when I say disrespect, is what we define disrespect as the issue. Okay? Rob, Surreal, someone calls you out your name, a racial slur. Someone spits on you. That's disrespectful. Right? To
right.
them, someone saying no is disrespectful because at the heart of it is power. When you have these people that have this type of power, how many times have we been on the phone or in person and we hear about someone assaulting a girl or raping a girl? We'd be like, and listen, don't take this wrong, audience, but it's like, damn, they rich. Why do they have to do that? Because we're thinking there's a million groupies out there. There's a million women that would sleep with them with their money. Like, why, how would they ever have to be in a situation where they assault a woman? I don't get it. And the reason I don't get it is because I don't get their power. Their power tells them, I'm sitting here. I want her right now. I'm going to have her.
Really,
I mean,
really quick. Two
things. Is that simple?
And then, no, I hear that. I hear that. Wait, two things. One is the HGH test is a done deal. That's done. It's happening. It's going to start this month, literally. So that is the policy. Welker's reinstated. All that is done. So already moved number one. And I think the second piece to this is, and we've all been watching the NFL for a very long time, you know, for forever. I'm looking at all these cases. I'm looking at Hardy. I'm looking at the Adrian Peterson. Now I'm looking at the Dwyer thing running on the screen, and Cardinals have immediately deactivated.
Yeah,
right. The precedent that is being set is unprecedented. And that's why I'm saying I don't know if we can necessarily start extrapolating like, oh, well, the player union has been this way and therefore it won't be this, or it's as simple as the power struggle, everything like now. The NFL, the most powerful sports organization in this country, is now having its rules and policies and procedures dictated by
the public outside,
1,000% different, you know.
Yes.
And it's like I think about you, what you're talking about, your structure of corporate America, and I mean that is what the NFL is. I mean, it is a bunch of rich white men who are controlling and making judgment calls, and so none of us would ever expect a rich white man to be sensitive to the needs of minorities and women. That's not what they do, and it filters on down from the top. Again, I think the precedent, though, that is being set here is what, when I text Surreal, what I meant by this is the biggest story in NFL history, not because of the things that are happening or the punishments, but rather the public outcry and outside forces are dictating those policies, which has never, ever happened before.
Yeah, ever. Not even close to ever happening. I mean,
yeah.
No, not even close to
so
ever.
That's what
that
I'm talking about
point,
in terms of weakness. Like, it's a weakness and a scare. I was listening to the Tony Kornheiser show, and I think this is what you're talking to a lot, Chad, but we can just get, like, right into the law of it. It's like, it is a scary, dangerous place to start taking away people's livelihoods off of accusations, right? Like, like we're not even talking about, like, the legal ramifications or the precedents that are being set
by these different things. We're just going into the action based off of the reports or the pictures of things that we have seen, which is absolutely, you know, absolutely at its most vile and disgusting in some cases. But again, the public outcry being the motivator for all of this is what I'm trying to formulate, is the iceberg.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's where I'm landing on it. Like, that's the piece of this that's like, huh. Like, yeah, I want Goodell to go because I think he's, I'm there with him. But I also think, like, I'm like, ooh, this is, like, if this looks to be true, like what's going on with Dwyer, you know, over a past, like, every NFL player
might
be running and ducking for cover. Like, every NFL player
might
be running
and
ducking for cover.
And say, listen, I'm sorry, let's meet for breakfast. And I'm not trying to make light of the conversation, because, you know, you're completely right. And it's the same reason, it's the opposite. Like, so, when you talk about the NFL, it's more, you know, the public. The NBA had to move so quickly because of the stars. You know, ultimately, it still comes down to money either way you look at it. But when it was Sterling, the first person that spoke out was LeBron James.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all the other superstars spoke out right after that. It's like, whoa, we got to move now, like yesterday. And once again, we're talking about the culture. Donald Sterling was Donald Sterling for 25 years in a day.
And everybody knew that. That's why you have yet to hear from David Stern, because
you'll never hear from David Stern. Not on that issue.
Yeah, I mean,
you ask him how he's doing, and he's gonna be off before you answer. Ask another question, because they've known that for years. And Rob, ultimately, to your point about the, you know, the public opinion, and we talk about the players, it's just a new day and time. Because of the outlets, you know, on the pre-show, we talked about how, you know, Surreal brought up the point about LeBron's hairline and him saying he lost weight. All of these snippets we hear now, we have access to that weren't there before. You know, so that visual of Ray Rice, that audio of Sterling, that type of stuff wasn't, I mean, Lord knows we would never want to hear or see what them Dallas Cowboys is doing in the 80s and 90s. It's just, we don't want to know. I mean, Lawrence Taylor is sitting there like, see, y'all thought I was, you know what I mean? Like, come on, dude, this is what it is.
If you want to know what
this is what it is.
For my listening audience out there, if you want to know what the Cowboys were doing in the 90s, just go to Netflix and go watch that movie. It was a famous football movie, North Dallas 40, and McNulty. That's what they were doing. That gives a great picture. And North Dallas 40 was made before, like 15, 20 years before that. But that's what they were doing. Getting high.
They were trying to recreate the movie.
Yes. Exactly. Wait, really quickly, the last thing, and I know everybody has to go. Just one thing that I want, like, the analogy that keeps coming to my head. And let me not make any, like, my position clear. Like, the individual acts are disgusting and should be prosecuted, should be followed through to the full extent of the law. Like, absolutely.
Right.
I'm thinking more of the broader implications of the NFL and how we could be looking at a power, like what I once thought of invincible entity, how we could literally be like watching its downfall right now, like watching it happen piece by piece. And so the analogy that comes to my mind, I've just been watching a lot of The Simpsons lately since the 12-day marathon.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was a Simpsons episode where it was Marge versus Itchy and Scratchy, where Marge suddenly saw Maggie was like, Maggie hit Homer in the head with a mallet. And Marge couldn't figure out where this is coming from, and then she figured out it was the Violet from Itchy and Scratchy. So she writes the petition, gets all the everything like that, and just like drums the speed, cartoon violence, everything, and just Itchy and Scratchy completely like nice thing. Then at the end of the episode, the another group wants the Statue of David to put pants on. Like, and Mark's like, oh no, this is a great work of art. Like, how can we do that? And the newscaster that they talked to is like, so how can you be for one thing and not the other? And she was like, well, I guess I can't. And that's how the episode ended. And it's your Scratchy return to the different thing. And so my analogy is like the worst thing that you can do as an organization is to base your foundation on public opinion, because public opinion is going to shift and change all
like the
of
wind,
the time.
Like the weather. I'll say this, Rob.
Yes.
Rob, your analogy is right on the money. But the analogy about the iceberg and it being public opinion is right on the money, because they never ever would have thought that the public would shift, would just change on them and flip on them based on the popularity, the money, Thursday Night Football, even despite all these warning signs, whether it was domestic abuse, the culture, none of that. It was like, okay, we're the most powerful, we're the biggest, we're the baddest. And the further iceberg that was coming, that eventually I think that was going to come even after this one, had this one not came, that they wasn't going to pay attention to, was the fact that young mothers are not going to let their sons play football with these concussions. That was the further iceberg I thought was coming in the next 10 to 15 years that they were going to ignore had this one not occurred.
And you
I really
know what, real
that.
Quick, so real to your point, real quick, I mean, I don't care what anybody's political stance is, but this reminds me so much of, like, in this case, the NFL are like Republicans, where they forget about the more domestic
violence. This is a major offense alert, Republican.
Is it a major offense
stance?
what I'm saying is, in recent history, you know, Republicans.
Put it out there, be real.
No, think about it. Even most recently, they were derogatory towards immigration.
Yep, absolutely.
Very derogatory towards women, people of color. And the reason it's funny to me, I can care less if you're racist, you know, bigot, whatever. But if you ultimately care about the dollar, you got to look at the numbers in front of you. And the Republicans are so far behind, you know what I mean, as far as trying to appeal to a different audience. It's a new day. And it's the NFL is the same way. Like, the stuff worked in the past, not even just because of exposure, but women didn't always have power. They just didn't. So no one cared when they cried. They didn't have the same type of power. And realizing how much women have as far as, you know, as a lead consumer, they should have been so far ahead of the curve on this one as it relates to any type of situation. And like I said, and please don't take this the wrong way, because the NFL does not care that you're getting hit, women. They don't. They don't. It's just about money. So I think women have to understand, like, listen, okay,
women happen to be the first button issue. Now we're at kids. The NFL doesn't care about human rights.
Right, exactly.
They don't care about dogs, puppies, kittens,
right.
Birds, women,
they
children.
They care about what you care about.
They care about the bottom line.
Yeah, whatever you're paying me, I care about. That's where they are.
Yes.
Whatever you're paying, that's what we care about. That's where our rights are right now. And I think that once they were so behind the curve on sensitivity in itself, like you said, and I said this a couple of weeks ago, that this ultimately is the human rights issue. It's just they don't care about the retired players, the ones that are having these concussions. Brett Favre talking, Brett Favre is a drama queen. but you know what I mean. He's saying he can't even remember what's going on, you know, sentences earlier. I mean,
John, wait, no. Forget Brett Favre. John Abraham, a linebacker for the Arizona Cardinals, left the team a week ago and was like, I'm leaving because I can't remember things right now.
Right.
That man is back in practice in this moment.
Yeah.
They called him and they got him back in there.
Yeah.
They
yes.
do not care.
No.
That man was like, I am losing my memory right now. And they were like, no, don't worry. God, everybody has memory loss at this time. Come on. Get in here and get things.
Look how they treated Johnny Unitas, a dude who helped build the league. I'll end with this. A little late, a little slow. Avon Barksdale, season one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well played.
Well played.
People,
I have nothing to
fun.
Add to that.
It's been real. It's been fun. No pun intended. I said it's been real. We will see. This is how I know we get tired. We
you should just
bad.
End it on a quote and then just drop the mic.
I know. I mess it up. That's what I do. It couldn't be perfect on a great.
Edit this last part
quote.
Out.
But it's been real. We will see you next week for another episode of Boardwalk Empire season 5, episode 3, What Jesus Says. And of course, some more NFL news. Hopefully we can actually get to some games with the NFL. There's a monster matchup coming up this Sunday, Super Bowl rematch, which I cannot wait. Denver, Seattle. So we'll definitely look back at that game without question. We'll work that into the program.
Don't say without question. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, Boardwalk Empire. Yes.
This
yes.
Wednesday.
Who,
next
no,
Wednesday.
You're absolutely right. The way it's going on right now, I don't know. Goodell might smack a woman. I don't know the way it's happening. Who knows?
Turn the show off. Turn the show off.
Edit.
Offensive alert.
No, you can't do the offensive alert after. You take the offensive thing. You got to say it before.
Actually, you can't even say it anymore. Now it's a joke. Now it's just ignorant. It's offensive to say offensive.
Hopefully we can get to the games next week. Just nobody get arrested. Please, just nobody get arrested or charged or anything. Let's talk about the games, maybe get into a little fantasy football. But we will see you next week. As always, thanks to Mr. Sapp, Mr. and Chad Quinn. So long,
all
fellas.
Right. Take care.
All right, fellas.
That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Surreal Quinn Review. I will see you next time. We'll see you Saturday. We'll talk about the world of sports. Have a great rest of the week. So long.